Welcome to the podcast series from the specialists at Penn Medicine. I'm Melanie Cole, and today we're highlighting AFib and stroke prevention. Joining me is Dr. Alexander Bridges. He's a cardiac surgeon with Penn Medicine. Dr. Bridges, thank you so much for joining us today. I'd like you to start by speaking a little bit about the prevalence of AFib, the scope of what we're discussing here today, and the main complications that we're trying to mitigate when we think about treating AFib.
Well, good morning, Melanie. It's a pleasure to be here. AFib is something that's near and dear to our practice. It's something we treat a lot. That's true, I think, of all cardiac surgery practices, probably worldwide. It's an incredibly common disease. We see it all the time. Depending on the reason the patient's being referred to the practice, coronary disease, valvular disease, multivalvular disease, the incidence of AFib that we see can vary significantly. The lowest incidence we see in coronary patients, then call it about 10% range, and then it rises well all the way up into maybe the 50-60% range for patients who have multivalvular disease, particularly mitral valve disease. For the past few decades, every year the incidence seems to increase by 3-5%. A lot of that is probably an aging population, but a lot of that's also probably just we're looking for it more, we're finding it more, we're doing more long-term rhythm monitoring.
Dr. Bridges, when we think of the complications, we hear about stroke, and we're going to talk about the treatments to try and mitigate that risk. But there are long-term complications and consequences if it's not found. So I'd like you to speak, please, about those complications and diagnoses, because sometimes it's found incidentally, sometimes patients don't know at all. Speak a little bit about that.
So I'm glad you mentioned stroke. One of the absolute most important parts of workup for anybody presenting with a new stroke is to look for heart rhythm abnormalities. And we also will usually get an echocardiogram and look for structural heart abnormalities, which can be associated with the rhythm or independent. Sometimes we find primary valvular lesions leading to a stroke, but a lot of the time we find that the patient has AFib and they haven't known it. They're not on any antiarrhythmic therapy. They're not on rate control therapy. They're not on blood thinners. It's a new diagnosis of a stroke and a new diagnosis of AFib, both at the same time. So that's the one that's on everybody's minds, and it's incredibly important. That factors for us very strongly into what we do during open heart surgery, particularly with management of the left atrial appendage. Anybody presenting for an operation who has a history of AFib should absolutely have their left atrial appendage addressed specifically to reduce lifetime risk of stroke. But as you pointed out, that's just one of the complications that can occur. The other that we think about all the time really is the long-term risk of heart failure. A substantial proportion of patients with atrial fibrillation will go on to develop what we call a tachyarrhythmia-induced cardiomyopathy, a fancy term for basically just the heart's getting chaotic signals, rapid signals, and it actually leads to a significant decline in heart function. This is something we see all the time. We see it really often in patients who have valvular disease as well, but we also see it in patients who have no valvular disease, and one can lead to the other. Patients who have atrial fibrillation for a long time develop structural changes in their heart that can actually predispose to valvular disease. More often, we see it the other way around, that it's structural valve disease, mitral regurgitation, mitral stenosis, leads downstream to atrial enlargement and subsequently to atrial fibrillation. We do actually see it going both ways. So fundamentally, the things we're trying to avoid are stroke, and we're trying to avoid heart failure.
Well, thank you for mentioning that it does go both ways. And so when we think of treatment, what problems are you trying to solve, Dr. Bridges? Are we looking to cure the AFib or reduce the risk of stroke, rate control, anticoagulation? It's really an interesting medical treatment paradigm. Speak a little bit about what you're trying to achieve and some of the options, ablation. There's a lot of things out there today.
So if you take the AFib as a disease that requires both medical management and occasionally invasive interventions, ablations, left atrial appendage ligation, if you think about it as a whole disease process, our goal is to cure AFib, stabilize a patient's heart rhythm, and in so doing, reduce their lifetime risk of stroke and heart failure. Some patients need a lot of interventions to make that happen. Some only need a few. Lots of patients get started on antiarrhythmic therapy, and their heart rhythm remains stable for a long, long time. There are patients who get a single episode of an ablation, percutaneous, done with a catheter by a cardiologist, for example, the electrophysiology division we have here, and get a durable lifetime cure. And then there's others we see in the operating room where we do a Mays procedure, for example, or some components of a Mays procedure and similarly cure them. That's what we're going for. If cure can't happen, or if maybe a patient doesn't want to undergo an open heart operation just to address AFib and there's no other reason for them to have open heart surgery, then long-term management is the goal. We want to keep a patient's heart rate normal. We want to keep a patient's heart rhythm normal. And we want to reduce a patient's risk of stroke with a blood thinner by addressing the left atrial appendage or both.
So I'd like you to speak about some of the surgical options, the interventional options that make it so that patients don't necessarily have to be on those oral anticoagulants for the rest of their life. You know, the Cox-Mays procedure, the Watchman, there are all sorts of things today. Speak about what you're doing there at Penn Medicine.
So this is a topic of ongoing research, ongoing debate, and very collegial discussions between cardiologists, primary care providers, and cardiac surgeons. And I don't think anybody knows exactly the right answer. The Cox-Mays procedure was developed back in the 1980s at Duke and at WashU. James Cox published first in about 1987 a series of patients where he had done open heart surgery and they had done what's called a Cox-Mays 3 procedure, what we now call the cut-and-sew Mays procedure, which was basically deconstructing the atria, cutting it into multiple pieces, and then stitching it back together. In the process, the left atrial appendage was taken away completely, so that was gone. But otherwise, the atrium was basically put together, but all of those suture lines, all of those cut lines, evolve into scar tissue, and then what we call these macro reentrance circuits and these trigger points were excluded. So basically, the atrium could only transmit normal signals in a normal way. And that procedure, I think a lot of people would still refer to it as the gold standard. It cures AFib well over 90% of the time. And patients are free from not only AFib, but they're free from being on antiarrhythmic drugs. And at that point, there's not a compelling reason, at least we would think, for a patient to be on an oral anticoagulant. If you do less than that, then we start to get a little bit worried that a patient in the absence of an oral anticoagulant drug still has a meaningful risk of stroke. Now, we're talking low single-digit percentage yearly risk of stroke, but that's not nothing. And as oral anticoagulant therapy has become safer and safer, that risk-benefit calculation, that risk-benefit comparison is sort of a moving target. And that's one of the exciting parts of the field is trying to figure out for each patient where their particular risk-benefit calculation says, okay, it's worth you being on an oral anticoagulant, even though you've had a Mays procedure, even though your left atrial appendage has been ligated. There are some studies showing that for patients who have various different heart rhythms and present with a stroke, within 30 days, they've been shown not to have a clot within the left atrial appendage. So if you take away the part of the heart that is considered to be the most risky, you can still develop a clot within your heart. So that need for the oral anticoagulants hasn't gone away. But having said that, if we take a patient with a low burden of AFib, if we do a curative operation, meaning, let's say, a full Cox-Mays procedure, we exclude the patient's left atrial appendage, and then we monitor their heart rhythm over the next year and show that they're not having any recurrent episodes of AFib, we in the cardiac surgery community think there's a compelling argument for those patients to be able to walk away from the oral anticoagulants completely. But that's a conversation to be had also with their cardiologist.
Isn't that interesting? So let's speak about the patient experience. If you have done a left atrial appendage closure device or the Cox-Mays, you've done one of these, and the patient is doing well, what then? What is their follow-up like? Speak a little bit about quality of life, because isn't that really what this is all about?
It is. And quality of life surveys continue to show that patients who had AFib with a lower quality of life and then have their AFib fixed have a better quality of life. So it really is meaningful, not only in terms of decreasing medication burden. So the patient experience really has a lot to do with how much AFib they're having coming in, whether they've developed heart failure, and whether they're needing a minimally invasive procedure, for example, a Watchman device, a percutaneous ablation, or whether they've needed open heart surgery. For example, in the U.S. today, only about 1,000 people are going to the operating room just for a Mays procedure every year. But tens of thousands of patients have a Mays procedure done while they're also having another open heart surgery performed. So we do a lot of Mays procedures. And we see a lot of patients recover from them. And we see routinely that the patients who are out of AFib have a simpler, more straightforward recovery. They have fewer follow-up appointments and they feel better. So they're still recovering from open heart surgery. Let's be clear. That takes a week in the hospital. They go to cardiac rehab. They're recovering for a few months. But you can tell that when you've gotten them back into a normal rhythm, things are simpler, things are more straightforward, and patients feel better. On the other end of the spectrum, when a patient comes in for an ablation, well, these are done as outpatient procedures by the cardiologists. And that's just fantastic when that can be done.
Well, it certainly is. It's a pretty exciting time in your field. And Dr. Bridges, one of the more important things when patients do have AFib, whether they are on medication or have undergone an intervention, is the multidisciplinary approach. Speak a little bit about your team and all of the providers that might be involved helping a patient navigate the world of AFib and stroke prevention.
If you look at the list of risk factors for AFib, the number one risk factor by far overwhelming everything is age. Nothing we can do about that. But going down the line, the next risk factors are hypertension, coronary disease, obesity, diabetes, sleep apnea. Every single one of those things, as we all know, are intimately associated with exercise, with nutrition, and with compliance with the newer medications. So all of this really does fit together. When we meet a patient who has metabolic syndrome or all of the typical risk factors for cardiovascular disease, those are the same risk factors for that patient developing AFib down the line. So from a primary care and preventative care perspective, it couldn't be more important. In terms of a multidisciplinary approach, at Lancaster, we're very lucky. The electrophysiology department here is absolutely fantastic. They've been leaders in the field, and we have an extremely collaborative relationship. So when a patient goes to see one of the electrophysiologists, if they feel the patient would be best served by a surgical left atrial appendage procedure or by an open Cox-Maze procedure or with one of those things in addition to another heart surgery, they send them over, they call us right away. When patients are being worked up for what feels like an unrelated procedure, maybe a transcatheter, aortic valve replacement, something like that. But if the patient has AFib, that's something to make us think maybe this patient's going to be better served by surgery, provided, again, that the risk-benefit ratio makes sense. So we're collaborative with the interventional cardiologists, the electrophysiologists, general cardiologists, and also the primary care doctor's offices. I think the heart group here at Lancaster General does an absolutely wonderful job of managing that.
Dr. Bridges, tell us about your clinical research at Lancaster General.
So here at Lancaster General, we're participating in a national trial. It's called the LEAPS trial. And this is a trial to investigate whether left atrial appendage exclusion, left atrial appendage ligation, basically taking away this part of the heart where blood clots can form, is something that should be done more often. It's a very straightforward and simple thing to do during an open heart operation. It doesn't really change the approach to the surgery, but we're trying to answer the question if patients who have a lot of risk factors for AFib but haven't yet been diagnosed, should we be doing something proactive at the time of cardiac surgery to reduce lifetime risk of stroke? Now, we don't know the answer to that question, so that's why we're participating in a randomized controlled trial. Our division is very passionate about atrial fibrillation and about trying to be proactive in helping patients going forward. That's one of the trials we're participating in right now.
Well, thank you for going over that. As we get ready to wrap up, Dr. Bridges, what would you recommend, first of all, for patients for whom AFib is largely managed, but who continue to experience premature ventricular contractions or flutters? And what would you like the key takeaways to be for other providers about referral, when it's important to refer, and what you would like them to take away from this episode today?
The spectrum of heart arrhythmias, premature atrial contractions, premature ventricular contractions, you mentioned, and beyond flutter, fib, supraventricular tachycardias, it's an enormous field. And there really is a concept of expertise in the field, and our electrophysiologists are just fantastic at that. Fortunately, premature ventricular contractions, PVCs, which we see all the time, don't appear to be a risk factor for patients developing AFib or going back into AFib if they do undergo a procedure. Separate mapping procedures can be done. Complex ablations within the ventricle can be done. Our electrophysiologists do them here, and we offer this. We have the ability to put patients on bypass to stabilize them while more invasive ablations are being done, although that's rarely needed. So in terms of the spectrum of arrhythmias, for the patients who've got AFib and A-flutter, I think the real message is that these are treatable conditions. The treatment should be tailored to the individual, and it's not that hard to do. Every once in a while, the surgeons do need to get involved with that. We're happy to help. Patients have an excellent recovery. Quality of life gets better. But certainly, if a patient needs open heart surgery for another reason, valvular disease, coronary disease, for example, and they also have AFib, that's absolutely something that should be treated. And I think that should bias patients towards thinking, maybe open heart surgery is something I want to do. Because at the same time as these other procedures, these other necessary procedures, we can also get rid of the AFib. We can take care of the AFib. We can reduce your lifetime risk of stroke. And that's, I think, an important message for patients and providers to hear.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bridges. What an informative episode this was. Thank you for joining us. And to refer your patient to Dr. Bridges at Penn Medicine, please call our 24/7 provider-only line at 877-937-PENN. Or you can submit your referral via our secure online referral form by visiting our website at pennmedicine.org/referyourpatient. That concludes this episode from the specialists at Penn Medicine. I'm Melanie Cole.